This episode of The Honeydew is brought to you by Ritual, Green Chef, and Keeps. More on that later. Let's get into the do.
The Honeydew with Ryan Sickler.
Welcome back to The Honeydew, y'all. We're over here doing it in the Nightpan Studios. I am Ryan Sickler, ryansickler.com, Ryan Sickler on all social media. Every episode, I'm going to tell you how much I appreciate you guys. This community continues to grow. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. You're getting audio on Mondays, video on Tuesdays. And if you need another episode a week, please sign up to the Patreon. Has become such a wild show. I say it, once we cast that line out to y'all, you have not disappointed in your lowlights out there. So if you or someone you know has that story that has to be heard, please submit to honeydewpodcast@gmail.com. The Patreon's $5 a month. That's it. I think for the year, if you sign up for a year, it's like $54 and you get like over a month of free episodes. So if you're in, do that. You'll save on some money. All right. Look, you guys know I record here at the Santa Monica Music Center. I'm really proud of a program we're doing right now. It's a nonprofit for some at-risk youth. We're working with the Santa Monica Police Department. It's called Outreach Through the Arts. We're bringing kids in the studio here to teach them about podcasting, editing, cameras, in front of the mic, behind the scenes, you know, doing what Ash does, doing what I do, giving them a curriculum and a course so they can go out and get these jobs where they don't have to work at Little Caesars for minimum wage. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying college may not be for everybody. So we're doing a give back program. I'll be telling you more about that as we keep going, but they're having a hell of a time right now. And I'm just really proud of it. So it's something I'm going to promote and get these kids some exposure. That's the biz, y'all. You know what we do here? We highlight the lowlights. These are the stories behind the storytellers. I'm very excited to have this guest here today. Honeydew getting big time names right now. First time here on the do, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bassem Youssef. All right.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh my God. Thank you. I feel the love. I feel the love.
Listen, I said before, I've been mesmerized by your eyes over here, bro. I get eye compliments, but man, you're just, I'm as straight as they come, but man, you're melting me, bro. You're melting me. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you here. Before we dive into any of this, please plug, promote everything and anything you'd like.
Okay. Right now?
Yeah, right now.
Oh, okay. I'm touring. I'm doing stand-up comedy everywhere. And I have a new book, a children's book called The Magical Reality of Nadia. And if I'm coming to your town, which I will announce soon, please come to my show. It is interesting and it is part of my story.
Are you touring internationally as well or just in the States?
Right now, I'm touring in the States. So I've been to Dallas, Tampa. That's during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Dallas, Tampa.
Those two states. Yeah.
New Jersey, then Houston. I've been in Timonium, Maryland. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to be in Ohio and Cuyahoga Falls and then Miami.
Have you done any overseas shows since the pandemic started?
Not since the pandemic.
I was just curious how much different it was.
I did London, but that's before the pandemic, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I researched you. I looked you up. I Wikipedia'd you. So who knows how much of that shit's real. But you're the fucking real deal, obviously. I've heard about you. I've known about you. But I didn't know all the shit that comes with you. Like you're, how do you say it? Cardiothoracic?
Cardiothoracic surgeon. A heart surgeon.
You were a heart surgeon.
Layman terminology. Heart surgeon.
I mean, you were literally a heart surgeon.
Yes.
Who shifted gears into comedy.
Yes.
By accident, you're telling me? Or
absolutely.
Absolutely by accident. Yeah. And then at what age?
39.
You're now 47. So 8 years in, you're a fucking heart surgeon. You got a children's book. You're a successful comedian. You're famous in how many goddamn countries?
I'm also vegan.
And you're vegan. I mean, just go fuck yourself.
And I did a show about it too.
8 years. So can we, you know what we do here. I say we highlight the lowlights. Let's start with, you know, where you're from originally, how you get into medicine, and then we can take it from there.
All right. So kind of the quick version of it. A very traditional upbringing in Egypt. Went to medical school. became a heart surgeon. Did that for 12 years after medical school.
At what age are you a heart surgeon?
25. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so let me, can I ask you a few questions about that?
Mm-hmm.
Craziest thing. How many surgeries would you say you've performed?
Oh, I can't even remember. 12 years.
We're talking about thousands? I mean, hundreds?
Yeah, because you see, in heart surgery, you first assist. You assist a lot.
Okay.
Until you do your own
surgery. Okay, but how many of your own would you say? Are we
I would say in the hundreds, yeah.
Okay. What's your success rate?
Oh, thank God. It's like 98%.
Is it really?
Yeah, yeah.
So you've only lost a couple, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That's damn good, 98%. Mm-hmm. You're who I want to fucking see. I don't care if we're on the road and I have a heart attack. I'm like, let me Sam look at me. So 98%, what's the craziest one you've ever – what's the craziest
surgery? The craziest stuff doesn't happen in the operation room in the heart surgery because most of the time people that come to the heart surgery, it's kind of – they're being prepared to the operation. It's the emergencies. You know,
have you had the emergencies?
Oh, yeah, yeah, gunshots.
So you're not just doing health and everything. You're doing, if someone gets shot in the heart, you're working on that too?
Yeah, yeah, that's heart surgery.
All of it.
Because there's a difference between a cardiologist and a heart surgeon.
I see.
A cardiologist, he's just like, he's an interventional.
That's okay.
But the heart surgeon, he actually cracks up your chest.
So what's the craziest stuff then? A gunshot?
Yeah, we had a gunshot and I had to, and I was the heart surgeon in on call. The guy who came in dead, and the thing is, his parents were out there. I think there was some sort of two families fighting each other from rural Egypt, and the family waiting outside, and of course, they were already angry. So it's kind of, we are the weakest link as doctors. So
yeah, don't kill the messenger, and you're the fucking messenger.
Yeah,
too.
And he already there is like his dad, and he was like, "What the hell are you gonna do?" There is nothing, and they were waiting for us outside, and then it was leaked that their relative was dead, and so they started to kind of destroy the emergency ward.
Oh man!
So we had to escape from the back door, but that happens a lot.
A lot.
Oh yeah, yeah. that's part of that is like every single intern resident story in an Egyptian hospital.
Do all the heart surgeons wear fucking sneakers and shit so you can run the fuck out of the back?
If you're just a doctor.
You don't want to wear those dress shoes.
No, sometimes we just like can take off our scrubs
and
then just like walk out. Do like a Kaiser Soze thing.
Stop limping on the way out.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever... I'm guessing you have. Have you had to be the person to go tell family members?
Oh, yeah, many times.
I mean, what is that like?
Yeah, it is.
How do you?
This will sound terrible, but it becomes part of your life, part of your routine. You're not phased out anymore. You're just like, yeah, on to the next patient.
Right.
On to the next case. This is the worst thing that happens for you when you're a medical professional. It just, they turn to cases.
I remember when my father died, I was 16 and I went to my doctor and he said to me, because he knew my dad, and he goes, listen, and it was such a human moment because I up to then, I'm 16, I looked at this guy like he's a doctor. He must know everything. You know what I mean? And he said, look, I want to tell you, they teach us in medical school how to deal with these things, but they don't teach you what to say about that to someone, especially a kid. So I don't even know what to fucking say to you. I'm really sorry. And I was like, damn, that was the first time I realized, like, you know, doctors are people too. Like, mm-hmm. you remember, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I remember being in like elementary school, maybe fifth grade, and seeing my teacher out at the mall or something. And I was like, oh my God, you're a real person?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just usually see you in this square room and you're teaching me this one fucking thing. So I thought that was a really cool moment. But I get it. I mean, obviously, if you're doing hundreds of them, it's like, yeah, he's dead.
Well, the projection that you just said about like how you project other people, mm-hmm. That could be the story of my life. And it was even augmented when I became a satirist. That's even worse. You're not just speaking to one person because of his parents. You're speaking to 40 million people. That's how many people are watching the show. And when you have so many people watching you, that's dangerous. Because 40 million people have an opinion about you. And it's that was kind of like part of the stress and the pressure that I was always under for the 8-9 years that I've been into the medium.
So what was the shift? What happened? Were you not happy being a... You say it was an accident, so let's hear how
I
that
I was
happens.
Never happy being a doctor.
Never?
Never.
Was it something your family wanted you to do? Was that a family practice?
Not a family practice, no. But that's... I make this joke all the time. I say, in the Middle East, you're expected to be one of three things. A doctor, an engineer, or a disappointment. So that's the expectations. And it doesn't matter how many times, just like, you know, it's there and it's just like imposed on you somehow. Parents will never say, oh, we never forced you. You got it by yourself. But it's kind of like,
what did your parents do?
My father was a judge and my mom was a business professor.
A judge. What kind of judge?
Supreme Court judge.
Supreme Court judge. Yeah. Holy crap.
Yeah. So, they were like, you know, middle class. Very respected people, but it is the part of the picture has to, the picture has to be complete, the social picture. So my older brother became an engineer. So one more slot for me. I became a doctor. Thank God we didn't have a third child, the third brother. He would be a disappointment.
He'd be the disappointment.
So we kind of like, so somebody had to take that. So I became the disappointment. No, just kidding. So
I was going to say, I mean, what happens when you shift? Do they?
No. The thing is like the whole country shifted. By 2011, I was already on my way to come to America because I passed all of my American exams, my USMLEs, and I had already a fellowship waiting for me here in America.
Where?
Cleveland.
Okay.
So I was going there. And then the revolution happened, the Arab Spring.
What year is this?
2011. Yeah, okay. 2011. So 2011 happened, and... I was part of the doctors that went to Tahrir Square to, you know, fix people's injuries. You know, there was like a lot of clashes and people getting shot and killed. And we just left everything and we went there. And when you are on the ground, you realize that there are two different types of realities. The reality that you know for sure, that you see for yourself, people wanting change, good people wanting a revolution, wanting democracy. And then there is the other reality that is propagated by the state-run media, which is a conspiracy. These are like, you know, insurgents. And I, all my life, I was mesmerized by John Stewart. He was the reason man. Why I understood even, not political satire, politics in America.
I'm not kidding you. I'm with you on that. I truly believe I got more informative, better news from John Stewart than CNN, any of these places, any of them. John Stewart was, and to come from MTV.
Yeah.
To come up through MTV and parlay that into... You know, The Daily Show and everything else, just amazing. He's the man. All the work he does with the firemen in 9/11 and all that, he's great.
And in 2001, that was the first time I saw him on television. I was visiting America. And
you had never heard of him or seen him prior to that?
No, we in the 1990s, like, how would you know? And then I started to watch his show, and I couldn't understand it because I didn't know who are Democrats, what are Republicans, what is Fox News. So he educated me about that. So always like in the back of my mind, can we ever have a show like this? But it's wishful thinking because we were living under a dictatorship. Then we have a revolution. And then suddenly there is like a space, an opportunity. So I started these YouTube videos.
Okay. So are you saying prior to the revolution, you weren't allowed to do YouTube chat, no shows like that at all?
No. You couldn't do anything that is related to politics at all. That you'll be picked up. You know, it was like a dictatorship that's been there for 30 years. It's kind of like a better dictatorship than we have now, but at that time, still a dictatorship. So
they would come get you if you did some shit like that.
Yeah. So okay. We had a revolution, and there is a space, an opportunity. So I did the YouTube videos, and I didn't think about this going anywhere. I was going to Cleveland, you know. Next thing I know, millions of views. Millions. 5 million views in a few weeks.
Wow.
And I know that, understand that. And I know that now you get 5 million views when your dog farts on TikTok. But at that time, 5 million views, 2011, in Egypt, that was a huge deal. That like no other videos actually did these kind of numbers. Suddenly, everybody stops me in the street. Suddenly, everybody knows me. Suddenly, I'm in the morning grounds with my doctors, with my professors, and patients are recognizing me. And it was funny because the patient was like, here's the funny guy from the internet. See, is he going to operate on me, please?
I would be scared,
like
too.
It's kind of like, it's like part of it is like starstruck. It's like, no, I don't want this guy to crack my chest open. Please, like, can somebody else take this? I don't want to be part of this, you know.
Love your show. You ain't working on me though, man.
So that was a little bit embarrassing, but I continued being a doctor. Like I continued being a doctor by doing the YouTube videos.
Did it end up conflicting?
No, but I did. I ended up having offers from television, and now I have to, and the same week that I got my my TV deal, the papers from Cleveland finally arrived, and now I have to make a choice.
So Cleveland or comedy, bro? It's comedy. You did the right.
No.
You did the right. No, it
was Cleveland or money, so I chose the money. Because it was like decent money. It was TV money.
Yeah.
So I did the show.
And so you get your own, what, like daily show?
Weekly.
Weekly show, yeah. In Egypt.
Yeah. And again, and then it exploded. 40 million people watching the show. 40 million people watching every episode. These are numbers never seen before. And now with the rise of the show, there's a rise of the Islamists. The Islamists came to the power too. So they didn't like what I have to say about
it. So are you getting death threats? Are you?
Yeah, but you see, here's the thing with death threats. When people tell, they kind of like, did somebody send me emails and comments and that? Like, I'm going to kill you a million times. That's why when people say, I got death threats. Really? Did you have somebody coming up your house and with a knife? Like, no, it's a comment on YouTube. It's like, bitch, I have this the whole time.
You got an email then.
It's just like, what the fuck? Like, seriously, you know, celebrity these days? It's like, oh, I've got a bullied death threat. All right. Imagine if you're having like 40 million people and half of them like hate watch your show.
Yeah, half.
And the government is against you. And you have militias coming up and having your pictures being burned, you know. So it's like, fuck you. It's like, yeah, I when people's like, were you threatened? It's like, yeah, but I didn't think about it. I had a show to do, you know. I was actually more worried about being slaughtered in Twitter if I have a bad episode
than
having a death threat. Yes, because if you have a death threat, what's the worst that you can happen? You're gonna die.
Yeah,
and you're gonna die like a hero, and that's it. And you don't have to worry about the preparation of the next show again. But if you have a bad show, you have no excuse. He's like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I had death threats, so I didn't write good jokes. Nobody cares. You are a commodity. You are a commodity. You're being thrown to the lions, and you have to perform no matter what.
Yes.
So I became this, you know, guy who does the show. And I woke up one day, and there's a warrant for my arrest from the Islamists. So I went there, and I was interrogated for 6 hours.
Why is there a warrant? What's
I was accused of 4 accounts, insulting the present, insulting Islam, spreading false rumors, and disrupting the fabric of society, whatever the fuck that means. And then
where is there? You're taken there. Do they come get you or do you go?
So the warrant was against me and I turned myself into the general prosecutor, kind of like the DA here.
Okay.
And
you're sitting with this.
Yeah. And for 6 hours, they're asking me to explain my jokes.
Nuh-uh. That's the worst thing.
I know.
Oh,
I
God,
know.
That is brutal.
I know. It's crazy. They're asking me, and it's crazy. It's like, what did you mean by this joke? So I said nothing. So why did the people laugh? It's like, guys, are you kidding me? And it was like for 6 hours, and they tried to even play the episodes, but they were playing it on a very outdated computer, so it was not working. So they ended up having transcripts, reading joke by joke. And the worst part about
that's
it is
awful.
Like, as they were reading my jokes, I was thinking, damn, these jokes are not that funny. So
I need new writers.
I know. Yeah, I did. So like, I went out on bail and I fired half of my staff. So. I know.
That's what you thought the crime was.
I don't know if they were really asking me if I'm breaking the law or because they're not funny enough.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. I mean, like, there was like a whole, like, I was being arrested and this was broadcasted on CNN, which is like the happiest.
Your arrest was?
It was broadcasted on CNN. So I was going there and then there was like a lot of, like, I was surrounded by policemen and then they put me in. And then the police officers, as they're putting me into, they asked me for selfies for their kids because it was a popular show.
Did they really?
They did, yeah. It's like, doctor, it's like, why don't you smile? It's like, why do you think I'm not smiling?
Because so everyone will call you doctor still?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm doctor. Yeah.
You are.
Like, I'm still today.
Comedy ain't getting rid of that.
Yeah.
Doctor.
So, yeah. And so I took pictures with the police officers and I posed a few times to give him the smile that he wants for his kid. And then, After the Islamists, by 2 months, the military came in and they removed the Islamists. Now, at that time, I was a national hero. I was the one who stood against the Islamists, right? And the military.
What is, hold on. We can't gloss over national hero. What does that feel like? Does it feel like anything to you? Seem like a very humble, grounded man that doesn't get too hyped up on your own bullshit. But
yeah, because
what does that
because
feel like?
I think part of it is that I became famous very late, and I became famous after being a doctor and being like, you know, kind of having a very tough life as a resident. So we're not used to praise. We used to be basically pounded on by our professors. And so this whole thing about like fame and being, you know, that much exposure, I'm not used to. So
and what's it like going out in public at this point?
Oh, it's torture. I couldn't. I mean, it's great and everything, but you couldn't. You couldn't have like so it's kind of like you cave in. You avoid public places. But then I was like, oh, but he's the one who stood against the Muslim Brotherhood. He's the one who grew an Islamist. And again, that was a projection that I never asked for because I always said, this is not an activist show. This is a comedy show. We don't care about your political projection about me because I am not. So now the military are in power, and I'm an equal opportunity offender. I don't care who's in power. I make fun who's in power. So I made one episode about the military, and I was canceled after one episode.
No way.
Yeah.
And then they're that fast.
No. And families and friends turned against me because if you think that in Egypt, if you think the religion is holy, the military is sacred. You can't even touch it.
More than religion?
100%.
Whoa, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So, the military was just like, it's there and untouchable.
Well, do you remember your joke?
No, it was not even the joke. It was joking about the propaganda of the military.
I see.
It
wasn't even really a joke.
The thing is, like, I never made fun of religion and I didn't make fun of the military. I made fun of the people who represent both, who like to hide. I always say small people hide behind big ideas. Mm-hmm. So small people hide behind the flag, patriotism, yeah. Religion, Allah, Jesus. And they kind of like, and so if you make fun of me, you make fun of all of these things that I'm hiding behind, which is, of course, bullshit.
Very well said. Yeah, it's bullshit.
So I made fun about all of their propaganda. And so I was canceled. People, my friends and family, many of them turned against me. Even my mom.
Your mom?
Yeah.
That's harsh.
No, seriously. My mom, but that was even, so after the military came in, there was martial laws and there was like people killed in the streets and it was terrible. So the show was suspended before we come back on air because there were martial laws.
How many episodes in are you at this point?
At that point, 2 years. Can't
wow.
Remember. But now there is, the military is now kind of showing signs of military fascism after religious fascism. So I started to write against it before my show is on the air again. My mom is not happy. She said, no, the military is the only one that can save us. You cannot say this about the military. And she was very angry at me. And for 10 days, we do not speak. And
is that a long time normally for you guys?
Yeah, because my mom is a typical mom that she always expects us to apologize. So this time I didn't. She's this one, a very, very proud woman. And on the 11th day, so on the 10th day, we talk. Small talk. I called her.
Okay.
I didn't speak. We didn't speak about what happened. But like, you feel there's a tension on the call. The next day, she died.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So she went in. She went to sleep and she never woke up. My dad called me the next day. Your mom died.
How old was she?
No, she was 64.
64.
Absolutely healthy.
Yeah.
So, after that, I do my show. And that is the one episode after which everybody turned against me. And I turned from, and now I'm thankful that my mom didn't get to see that because she didn't see the turn against me. So kind of, that's the first blessing in disguise. Now.
Can I just ask you a few questions here about your mom's passing? Mm-hmm. Were you very close to your mom?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, how glad are you that you called? You wait one more day and you don't talk to her ever again. The way you go out is on an argument.
Well, I am glad, but like, if that didn't happen, I mean, I don't want to beat myself up to that because I didn't kill her, you know. And maybe if I continue to do the show and then she saw the stuff that's happening to me and the turn and something happened, maybe I would have felt guilty. But you know, it happened. And
So what
she died very peacefully in her sleep, and then I did the and then I continued doing the show, and then this one episode, and then everybody turns against me. Now I'm the most hated person in Egypt by the propaganda, right? Many people still like me, but they are afraid to speak up. Now, I stay unemployed for 4 months. I go to another network, a regional network, and I go in for another run a few months, and then I get canceled again. And now there is it's becoming more and more difficult to stay in Egypt. And now there is a court cases against me. All of these fake stuff that actually make you kind of like put you in jail, but without using the whole idea about freedom of expression, mm-hmm. you know, taxes, whatever. Then I had a verdict against me, fining me £100 million out of nowhere. The lawyer said, you need to leave Egypt. I leave Egypt. I never come back. I leave Egypt on 10th of November, 2014. I leave. I go to Dubai. 3 months later, my father dies in a car accident.
Now,
both of my parents died. But here's the blessing in disguise. Both of my parents died suddenly. My mom died in her sleep. My dad, he died in a car accident. They did not suffer. They died instantly. It's devastating. They're taken away from you. But now, I saw both of my grandparents from both sides dying very slow, humiliating death. Dementia, diapers, Alzheimer's, the works. My grandmother from my mother's side was in bed for 10 years, and she was like, she couldn't understand. And you know when you say like, oh, I hope she's just like, she rests. Mm-hmm. I was always in fear of seeing my dad and my mom going through this.
That, yeah.
So when they died, all I have of them are memories of very strong, independent people. And they didn't, and now that I'm uprooted from my own country, I'm in America, I don't have to worry about them anymore. So that's why I tell you it is a tragedy, but it's a blessing in disguise. A big, 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 like a blessing in disguise. So now comes to the trauma, the big trauma now. The big trauma is not the death. The big trauma is like how you're uprooted and everything that you worked for. And I did a show that it was never done in the history of the Arab world. 40 million people watching me.
Were there other copycat shows after you started?
All failed. Yeah. And then I have nothing. I'm a has-been now.
And in the span of what are we talk? 3 years?
4 years, yeah.
4 years.
Yeah. And now the only way that I could stay in the Middle East is that I had to compromise. The military intelligence would send people to me, come back and do the show, but would kind of be some sort of an understanding. Hey, take a game show. Do a game show. do something that is not related to politics. Speak to celebrities. Do like Jimmy Fallon kind of thing. Don't do politics.
Don't do you.
Yeah, and I left everything, and I came to America.
Had you been here before for any reason?
America?
Yeah.
Oh, I visited America a lot. I always visit America. I mean, I always like being in America. And so I come here, and I have nothing. And now this is where the trauma is.
Where do you go first?
Oakland, and then I
went. Oakland?
Yeah.
What made you pick Oakland?
We had friends there that kind of we stayed because we needed to ground ourselves.
From Egypt to Oakland, huh?
Yeah.
That's tight.
Then I leave.
I know. I like that, dude.
I know. And I leave that and I come to Los Angeles. Now I'm someone who's huge in the Middle East, but doesn't matter here. You're nobody here. And now you have to build your career from the ground up again. And the difficulty is not just trying to make it here, but also having to deal with your fans who always follow you and consider you as a failure because you cannot do the show anymore. And it's like, why don't you do the show from YouTube? I was just like, why? It's no point anymore. And then I started to try to build my name here very slowly. So I started to give lectures, talks. Then I took this lecture and talks and I turned them into stand-up.
Okay, so your lectures and talks on what? Are you back to cardio?
No. Like talks about my experience. Now I'm done with medicine.
Got it.
And I make
stay that way.
Yeah, I make this joke like I'm not a doctor anymore, and because of that, many more patients are alive today. So I'm here, and now I start doing stand-up.
Let's take a quick break and tell you about our first sponsor, Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. You won't find sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design makes taking your vitamins easy. I take Ritual every day. I just got my monthly shipment again the other day. I'm actually buying them. I really like them. For years, I've been looking for a daily vitamin that didn't have all the fillers and everything in it. And Ritual's been fantastic. And it does have a really clean, refreshing taste that you actually doesn't, you know, when you take stuff and it gets stuck back in your throat, you're like, and then you get it down and you taste that all day. Not with Ritual. All right. Ritual is designed with you in mind, and it's now available for women, men, and teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Ritual makes healthy habits easy. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual, within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. All right. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. So visit ritual.com/honeydew to start your Ritual today. Our next sponsor is Green Chef. Green Chef is the first USDA certified organic meal kit company. You can enjoy clean ingredients that you can trust, seasonally sourced for peak freshness. Green Chef is the most sustainable meal kit, offsetting 100% of its direct carbon emissions and plastic packaging in every box, so you can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table. Ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly portioned, and mostly prepped, so you can spend less time stressing and more time enjoying delicious home-cooked meals. Green Chef makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every lifestyle. So whether you're keto, you're paleo, you're vegan, you're vegetarian, or if you're just looking to eat healthier like me, there's a range of recipes to suit any diet or preference. Look, I know all the paleos and the ketos and the this is and the that. They don't work for me because I can't stick with it long enough. That's just the truth. I'll get weak. I'll eat pizza. I'll go out and have tacos, whatever it is. But with Green Chef, they definitely send you the stuff portioned out. It's easy to make. I'm not spending all night in the kitchen. You know, make a handful of meals throughout the week and take care of yourself. You feel so much better in the end. Go to greenchef.com/90honeydew and use code 90honeydew, that's 90honeydew, to get $90 off, including free shipping. That's $90 off, including free shipping, when you go to greenchef.com/90honeydew and use code 90honeydew at checkout. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. Our next sponsor is Keeps. Did you know 2 out of 3 men will experience some form of hair loss by the time they are 35? Keeps offers a simple, stress-free way to keep your hair. Low-cost treatments start at just $10 a month, and Keeps offers generic versions. There's convenient virtual doctor consultations and medications delivered straight to your door every 3 months. You do not have to even leave your home. They have discreet packaging and proven results. Keeps has more 5-star reviews than any of its competitors. All right, treatments can take 4 to 6 months to see results, so act fast. You know Keeps keeps coming back because you all keep using them, and they're a great company. Plenty of people here at the studio are using them. I got friends using Keeps right now. I know dudes back in the day in my high school and college days that would have loved to have something like Keeps to keep that hair because they are bald. All right. So if you are ready to take action and prevent hair loss, go to KEEPS.com/honeydew to receive your first month of treatment for free. That's KEEPS.com/honeydew to receive your first month free. KEEPS.com/honeydew. Now, let's get back to the do. Where's the first place you went?
Certain place in Los Angeles, New York, and it was terrible.
It's terrible.
English is my second language. And it's not just the language. It's not just the jokes. It's the delivery. It's rewiring your brain for the right cadence, the right speed, the right rhythm. I have to relearn how to speak.
Yeah, you got to be a whole different person.
Yeah.
I mean, you've had to learn how to be that's crazy. I couldn't imagine that, going to another country and then being like, oh, man, I've been doing it this way all this time.
Yeah. So I managed to get a residency in Joe's Pub in New York. Stayed there for 2 months. Some nights were better than the others. Some nights were terrible. Other nights were okay. And then after 2 years, and now I have like a tour. And I'm going. And I'm doing it in mixed rooms between Arabs and Americans. And I am pitching shows for HBO and waiting for the results. And I'm pitching, and now I have a children's show that's doing very well. And I have an animation studio that wants to take this book to turn it into an animation series. So I'm still getting around here. And I'm the age of 47, and I'm doing stuff that young 22 years comedians do. But I'm happy, because it is very scary, very unsettling. But I'm learning something every day. Some days I will be in a theater like the Kennedy Center with 2,000 seats watching the show. And some that time I will be in Timonium, Maryland, doing the show for 18 people. And I would tell you, the smaller rooms are a blessing, because they teach you stuff that you cannot, that you cannot learn from the bigger rooms. And I think the one thing that I was struggling with is the whole idea of, am I good enough? Am I talented enough? Was that a fluke? Was it just like all luck? And I'm not really that good. And that kind of like self-doubt, that kind of always, oh, the imposter syndrome, everybody has it. And I'm still asking these questions every day. And same. I'm still always doing it every day. So, but at least I'm...
I think it keeps you in check. You know, it really humbles you and keeps you grounded and keeps yourself in check.
Yeah. So a lot of people look at the first transformation between a doctor and a medical and a comedian and say like, oh, that's huge. But I would think that the second reinvention,
I agree,
was even much more difficult, because you're coming here.
I've never been a doctor, and I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second reinvention, going from doctor to comedian, would be easier than going from
someone who's so big in Egypt to no one in America and trying to do it.
And that, restarting, not just restarting, but refinding yourself.
Refinding yourself. And until today, you have Egyptians, big fans, come to the shows like, why don't you do it in Arabic? So even your some of your fans not even accepting that. If you're not doing the show, you're not relevant. And I discovered that those people are just locking themselves into, not just in the show, they're locking themselves into that era, the 2-3 years when we had hope, because that is kind of more nostalgic. It's not about the show, but what it represented. And I had a third reinvention. So in the middle of all of this, I turned plant-based diet vegan. Right.
Wait, let me ask you before we get into vegan.
Because that's actually like a third intervention. This is not just like, I say I'm Arab and vegan, which makes me scary and annoying. But I promise you, this is not going to be an annoying story.
I believe you. I just want to know, have you gone back and done any stand up or anything anywhere close to home?
In Jordan, in Lebanon.
How was it?
It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a good turnout. People really come.
Yeah, but they're still coming in expecting the show.
Yeah, they are, huh? Yeah, not stand up.
Yeah.
Okay, so we go to. So what makes you do that?
2013, I became plant based diet because a friend of mine had MS and he kind of reversed his disease. So
he really did.
Yeah. So for me, I switched to plant based diet not because of like, you know, not for ethical reasons, which I do respect that when people do that, but it's more of health reasons. So I'm not militant. I would cheat every now and then. It's fine.
What's a cheat meal for you?
It's just like a little bit of cheese, you know, like a pizza, whatever, you know. So. Then I started to speak about that. And then people ridiculed me. It's like, oh, it's because you cannot speak about politics. You're speaking about food. Why don't you go back and make me a sandwich? You know? You know?
You got to love the assholes.
Yeah, yeah. So suddenly I'm a woman now.
Yeah.
So that made me angry. So I said, I'm going to make the one thing that people make fun of the most successful thing that I do. So I created a website. It's called planb.tv. It's the only bilingual website in the world about plant-based diet. It has videos, it has recipes, it has success stories, it has articles, everything.
So what's the website again?
Plant B.
That's what I wanted to make sure.
.tv, not Plan B.
Yeah.
And it's meant to be, because I tell people, if you're eating your steaks and chicken and happy, dude, good for you. But if you have a problem, try Plan B. Plants. So that's how we do it. So, and then I managed to take the video, the online video, And I sold a show to a TV network in the Middle East about plant-based diet. So I did the same thing when I did with the political satire show. Took it from the internet and did a whole show. And I sold it. And now I'm negotiating even a bigger deal with a bigger network.
Really?
To do a reality TV show about transformation, about getting people. It's kind of like The Biggest Loser, but instead of losing pounds and weight, you're losing medications. Only through plant-based
Ooh,
diet.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Okay.
So I'm doing that. And then I'm now turning Plant B into an app where people are going to have like a paid subscription in order to have medical coaching, medical consultation. And so I'm bringing in investors. I already brought in an investor. So
you're a fucking juggernaut. Dude.
So it's kind of now, it's kind of like I was pissed because how people would kind of.
Can we stop for a second? Yes. We cannot gloss over your friend had MS and reversed his effects. That's major. What plant-based diet and what changes do you see? Is it gone or is it minimalized? What are we talking about?
No, it's totally under control. So he used to have like five symptoms, you know, his ear. There's some stuff that are reversible. So his left ear is like 20% gone, but he had like tingling, like, you know, paresis, pain, and that's all gone now. And he's now playing water polo again. And he has these retreats where people come in for water fasting. So he did it by two things, water fasting and refeeding on plant-based diet. So as a doctor, I was one of those people who made fun of vegans all the time. But now I started to read about it, and basically it's about reducing inflammation. Here in California, you have Loma Linda. Loma Linda is one of the blue zones. And the reason why it's
called a blue zone?
Yeah, there's like five blue zones around the world.
Okay, what's a blue zone? I have no idea.
A blue zone where you have the population of that region have much longer life expectancy and much less chronic diseases.
And where is that? Loma Linda, where else around?
Loma Linda is the only one in America. There is Okinawa in Japan. There is one in Italy. There is one in... I forgot the last two. There's one in Costa Rica, and there's one more. So, and then they found that these people have a much more plant-based diet-based food, and if they eat fish or meat, they're like in very, very, very small amounts. So
fish in small amounts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fish or even meat in small amounts, very, very small amounts. So, There's a lot of science. There's a lot of papers, and it's much more researched than any other of those like keto or paleo diets. So I watched documentaries. I attended their conferences, and I got sold. And I said, this is the way to do. And again, this is not like about. It's not militant. I even tell people it's not. It's what you do 90%, 80% of your life. If you want to, you know, cheat every now and then, that's fine. But if you have a chronic disease, I recommend that you go more 100%. So now I'm changing people's mind through food, and now I have more followers. And there are people are meeting me in the Middle East. It's like, I didn't know that you had a comedy show. I knew you from the plant-based diet show. So,
fuck yeah. So how long have you been plant-based?
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
And what do you notice differently about yourself? Because you said you used to make fun of the vegans. So what? How much different has
it? Well, first of all, my eyes were brown. Now they're blue. I'm just kidding. Because that's the first thing you said. No, I feel much more healthier. I'm much more rested. I have less
bones,
inflammation.
Joints feel better.
Yeah, my recovery time is much better. I mean, there is like one of the best show of movies, documentaries, The Game Changers. It's incredible. It's about vegan athletes. And
it's called The Game Changer?
The Game Changes.
Oh, The Game Changes.
Yeah. And now you have people who are like elite athletes who are on plant-based diet. It's great. Yeah. So when I do it, I don't do it in a way kind of like to change people's lifestyle. I said, like, if you're happy with your lifestyle, whatever meat and chicken you're eating, that's fine. But you have chronic problems. If you have problem with your sleeping, with your energy, maybe you would like to try something else. And a lot of people try it. Maybe I do even have a 21 days challenge. People do it and they feel amazing. And then they come back and they eat a little bit of meat, but not as much as they used to. So they kind of change their mind. So kind of like my whole life now is kind of like reinvention and trying to challenge yourselves and putting yourself in places where you're not very comfortable.
I'm a big believer in getting yourself out of your comfort zone. I'm a big believer in change. Change is a pain in the ass, but it is so necessary.
Yeah.
It is so necessary. Every time change has been even forced upon me, I've been able to adapt and move on and then look back and be like, thank God this happened. Thank God this happened. Yeah. So is that it's been thrown at you your whole life like that, it sounds like. Well, wait, up you, we did talk about before you got on. You said you had no trauma. You had a solid run for a while there without any craziness. Yeah,
I don't know. Like, people talk, I mean, being in the Middle East in itself is a trauma.
I mean, I didn't want to say.
I mean,
it definitely is. You're used to shit. We're not.
I mean, it's just like, you know, it is a trauma. You know, I on my show, I make this joke. I say, like, whenever you find a white male shooter, he's crazy. It's like, well, the Middle Easterners, we could be crazy. There's a thousand things in the Middle East that drives us crazy. Let me give you an example. You guys send your troops to the Middle East, they come back with PTSD. We fucking live there.
Yeah,
we live there. We have the source code of craziness. We could be crazy, you know. So the Middle East is just like a big bag of trauma. Since we've just been living there all our lives, we don't feel it. It's kind of like, oh, it's like we come here to the, you come here and Americans like are you know, are complaining of something. It's like, oh, that's normal. I made fun when I was in Houston. I went there in that terrible week when they had like shortage of everything and power cuts.
Oh, you were down there?
Yeah, I went there. I went there like the day that Ted Cruz left to Cancun. I came in as a savior from Los Angeles. So I the first thing I said, like, guys, like this week, this is terrible. I mean, look at you guys. I mean, you had like failing infrastructures, corrupt politicians, absolute lack of human rights, like heat, electricity and water. Americans were like, oh my God, that's terrible. Arabs were like, welcome to our lives, bitches.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I was like, but this is the apocalypse. Like, back home, that's Tuesday. So it's kind of like, we're used to a lot of shit, but I think because we lived through that all our lives and through a generational kind of acceptance of that's what life is, maybe there is trauma, but we don't really realize it's trauma.
Yeah, but there's more to you. There's the hustle that I love so much. I see, where does that come from? Where does that work ethic that's instilled in you, that don't give up, don't like, we're gonna go do this now instead of woe is me? Who does that come from?
Being a nerd.
A nerd? You were a nerd growing up?
Medical school, bro.
I mean, still, doctors fuck, bro. Doctors fuck.
No, but like, seriously, like, I think it is, maybe it's the way that we were raised. I mean, we were raised not to complain. You get good grades, good for you, not for us. It's just, it was always expected that you need to overperform, even to overdeliver. That is not something that you should be rewarded to or being, you know, have a pat on the back. That is just what it is.
It's expected.
It's expected. And at the end of the day, it's like,
I agree. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you don't do it, you're going to fail. You're going to survive. You need to survive. And I think I always talk to myself saying that I need to stop. I need to remind my entitled self that the world doesn't owe me anything.
That's right. It sure as fuck doesn't.
And I think we all need to remind our entitled selves that the world doesn't owe you anything. It's like, oh good, okay, so you were uprooted, you were investigated or interrogated, the show was taken, boo-hoo, all right. Nobody's going to give you a handout.
I don't know any fucking comedians that's happened to and then had to go to another country and start over and be as successful.
And as a matter of fact, if you kind of like cower and wail, that's exactly what is... But all of these things, all of these people want from you. Nobody's going to say, all right, come out now. It's fine. No, that's life. So, and if you do it, like the people who hate you, I think for a very long time, I was kind of motivated by revenge. And this is the wrong motive.
Revenge on who or what?
Revenge of all of the people who doubted me, who kind of reveled in my failure of having everything that's taken away from me, who always kind of like made sure that like, oh, you're done, you're a has-been. Because that gets to you. And so now when I'm kind of like having a moderate success, I feel like even if I got the best thing, if I won an Oscar tomorrow, It doesn't matter. The trolls will always be trolls. The haters are not going to be haters. And then at the end of the day, if you got your Oscars, your Golden Globes, your Emmys, your specials on Netflix, your bestsellers, your $1 million deal, who are these people? Why are they important for you to take revenge at them? They're not. I think it was, for a very long time, I knew this was a very negative impulse.
You did know.
I did know, but I couldn't help it. But now when I say I'm much more relaxed, I'm much more, I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it to prove to myself that I still exist. I'm still relevant. I can still create. Yeah. I'm happier. So
I've always used it instead of revenge as fuel. You know, you too. Oh, you don't. Thank you. Just put it in the tank. Put it in the tank. Put it in the tank. Mm. You know, and then use it to fuel you instead of force you away from something. Motivation.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I think the if this is a show about the lowlights and about the trauma, it's always about kind of that uncertainty that always had. It was an uncertainty that came after like a very, very huge success, because the success was meteoric. It's like three years, boom, you're on top of the world, and then boom, it's taken away from you. And now you have to climb your way up again. Very, very. Yeah, now you have to play with the rules. That right. applies for everybody.
Right. But you're doing it.
We'll see.
You're doing it.
When I do that, when I get my that Netflix special, I'll tell you.
I want to go back and ask you your parents. Who was the bigger disciplinarian, mom or dad?
Mom.
Mom. It sounds like mom when you said. And then were your parents still married when your mom passed? They were. Did you get any closer to your father during those few years where he was still alive? And
yeah, well, my dad is one of those people that you appreciate them much later in life. My dad was very, was passive. He was like, you know, minding his own business. He always wanted to have his space.
Well, you said he's a judge, though, and I've been in front of my share of judges, and I got to say, of all the people I've dealt with in my life, judges seem to be right here. Like, mm-hmm. It didn't matter what anyone ever said offensive to him. They would just go, okay.
Yeah, okay. He was one of that.
I was amazed by that. Like, yeah. You've seen so much and probably heard so much, you're desensitized to the people taking these shots at you to the point where it just, you know, just bounces right off.
My dad was that, and because he was quiet and my mom was the most vocal, you get attracted. You look at your mom as the source of authority. You look at your mom
as the judge and she's the jury.
Yeah. She's the judge and the jury and the executioner.
She's all of them.
She's everything. But I didn't appreciate my dad until very much later in life. I saw how much of an incredible dad, an incredible man he was, and he did everything quietly. He didn't make a fuss about anything.
In what ways was he?
Like, I mean, he was there. He provides. He did. He was just like making sure that everything. But it's kind of like because you're a kid, you don't see. It's like, you know, like the duck in the water. You don't see her legs. Mm-hmm. That was not my dad. So
yeah, I mean, parenting is a long game. It's a long, slow play, and
yeah,
it doesn't pay reward. If you've done your job half as good as you hope to, then yeah, your kids might not realize. I look back on my dad had twins in 1973. I'm 47 and I just, you know, he's gone now, but he was at every fucking practice, at every game. He was I look back now like, how in the hell did you do it? We worked an hour from where we lived. Like, how the hell did you do it? And I start to look back on all those things and, you know, there's so many questions I wish I could ask him now. But yeah, I get that. Mm-hmm. I get that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I mean, my mom was like one of those women who were she was very flamboyant. She was Taurus. She was always there. So she needed the gratification, you know, appreciation. My dad didn't need any of that. He was just in his own head.
And are you and your brother close?
Yeah.
And is he still in Egypt?
Yeah.
He is. Is he still an engineer?
Yes.
Did he ever want to work for you? Did he ever want to come on the show?
No.
He didn't.
My brother always kind of like, you know, just kind of like watched from afar. We're still good. He's a wonderful brother.
Now you said some of your other family turned on you. Are they still Are you still excommunicated from them or what?
Well, half of them are dead. Half of the other half, we don't speak anymore.
You don't?
Yeah.
They don't hit you up or?
No, it's fine. I mean, I think with my parents dying, as if the connections were severed. As if there was a sign from me. It was like, all right, you can go now.
And you can go now.
Yeah.
So go pursue this.
So Los Angeles is my home. The United States is my country. And I deal with it as this way. I try as much as possible not to let whatever is back there annoy me.
So would you want to do another show like that?
I don't know.
No?
I really don't know. I stopped thinking about it a long time ago. I'm focused about what I do now.
Are you still doing the plant-based show?
Yeah.
You still have that going, though?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Say it again, plantb.tv.
Yeah.
TV.
Okay. Yeah.
And what have you surprisingly, what meals do you think you wouldn't expect to be good? Like if I'm sitting here like, what's the first thing I try be to get me hooked?
I can't help you.
You can't give me one suggestion?
No, because
you all got a fake chicken parm, right?
No, because here's the thing. It's a philosophy about trying to reduce what's bad for you. It's more about excluding the stuff that shouldn't eat. So the thing is, it's not an instant thing because your taste buds takes time until they're used. So for example, now when I eat arugula or spinach, they taste sweet.
Really?
Yeah, because
You've done it so long.
Because my taste buds are not blunted anymore by all of the oil and the salt and the sugar and all of the processed stuff. So now I enjoy kind of much more basic food, and it tastes much better.
Okay.
I was one of those people. I was a typical Egyptian with three or four spoons of sugar in my tea.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, that's very
common.
Very Egyptian.
Wow.
Three, four spoons of sugar.
In your tea?
In my tea.
Daily?
Yeah. Now I can't even put half a spoon. I can't.
What does it do to your body?
Sugar?
Yeah.
What doesn't it do to your body?
honestly, if you had a cup of that right now,
oh no,
would you get sick? Would you?
I wouldn't even one sip would just it's like I can't. And but it's like it's the whole thing about like it all comes down to one thing: inflammation. It's the kind of inflammation that these foods does to you. Yeah. So
do you have any children?
I have Nadia. That the book, the children's book, that magical reality of Nadia is based on her. She's nine.
She's nine.
And Adam is 3.5.
So you have a 9 and a 3.5.
Yeah.
Man, you did a little late like me. Mm-hmm. I got a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
I should fucking go plant-based. I could probably move around better.
Watch The Game Changers and Forks Over Knives. Maybe it's a good start.
All right. And where are your daughters now?
My daughter is in the... I think we're in Redondo Beach. So the schools now are kind of 50%. So they are in school 50% and online 50%.
Okay. Yeah. And are you married?
Yeah.
You are? You don't wear a ring?
Well, I mean, we don't wear a ring because we do a very active life and kind of she doesn't wear a ring. We don't let this stuff define our relationship.
No, I hear you. I'm big on that too. I believe in that.
And this is all pagan rituals anyways.
I love it. I want to learn, bro. Look, I know we got to get you out of here. So I want to ask you, after everything we've talked about now, going back to 16-year-old you, what advice would you give to 16-year-old Bassa?
Oh, that's easy. Buy Bitcoin.
You would, huh?
Absolutely, man. What the hell? I would be buying Bitcoin since when it was 6 cents.
Do you have it now?
No, I have nothing.
And I would go back and tell yourself to do it.
I missed out, man. Fucking buy Bitcoin. That's it.
I love it. Please, one more time, plug anything you'd like.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to be in Cahoga Falls, Ohio, 11th to 13th of March. Miami, 19th to 21st of March, which is my birthday, by the way. Buy the book. It's a children's book. It's a beautiful book based on Nadia, and it has magic, ancient Egyptian history, and it's a really cool book, and it is really topping the chart now. So it's called The Magical Reality of Nadia, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. This has been really great. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
As always, RyanSickler.com, Ryan Sickler on all social media. We'll talk to you all next week.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.